I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester, his name is John Anilio, and you're listening to episode number 155 of the Functional Nerds Podcast.
Oh, that's impressive. That's an impressive number of podcasts. That is Patrick Hester. He's an author, a blogger, and a podcast dude. You can check out his website, atfmb.com. You can follow him on Twitter, at atfmb. I am John Anilio. I write songs, and I compose instrumental music, and you can check all of that stuff out at johnanilio.com. Most of it you can download for free. And you can follow me on Twitter, at John Anilio. Today, once again, we are joined by Jeff Patterson. Jeff is a writer, illustrator, blogger, and the mastermind of Bad Day Studio. He's the least educated but better-looking third of the podcast team known as the Three Horsemen at SF Signal. His Twitter handle is JeffPatterson11, and his new book, Don't Tweet Where You Eat, is culled from his Twitter feed. He blogs at Gravity Lens, which can be found at baddaystudio.com. Jeff, thank you again for joining us.
Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for having me.
And John, do you know that Jeff blames me for that ebook?
No. Well, you know what, Jeff? Why don't you tell us a little bit about that ebook and you know, where people can pick it up and all that.
It's an ebook I wrote. It's available on Kindle. It is basically roughly about a year's worth of tweets, one-liners, jokes, snarky comments, observations, etc. I call it bathroom reading for nerds. And it was pretty much my getting onto Twitter was spurred by Mr. Hester in 2012, and I got on there and took to it like a duck to water, and a few people made some comments earlier this year that maybe I should collect a bunch of my tweets and publish them, much as Mr. Hester had with his conversations with my cat. So I said, all right, I'll do that, and it took me about 6 weeks to get everything organized on Scrivener, another thing that I blame Patrick for. And once I had done that, I got it up, and it is currently out for Kindle. I actually have an Amazon page now because I have two ebooks out. And I've gotten some pretty good feedback on it.
I got an email just a couple days ago from an author named Judith Gunn who said that my Scrivener quick tips are why she now has an ebook, because she got Scrivener. Mm-hmm. She was searching for how to do ebooks. She found my website because I have all the Scrivener quick tips up there, and that helped her format everything. And now her ebook is up and available at Amazon, which I thought was kind of cool. Now, I don't know if you noticed this, Jeff, but there's a new thing on my blog called Conversations with Stupid.
No, I have not.
And this is conversations with my cats from the feline's perspective. So conversations with Stupid.
Well, there you go.
Yes, and it's pretty funny so far. I mean, people. I actually had DiNardo on Skype when he read the first one, and I thought he was going to pee himself. He was laughing so hard.
Well, DiNardo pees himself a lot. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, I cut Jeff off there. It's a Zoe's Tale, the Scalzi thing. Yeah.
Kind of like Zoe's Tale by Scalzi.
Yes. Yeah. I was trying to make a joke about DiNardo's incontinence, but I guess you know.
Hey-o! Great.
I still love.
Great. Now I'm gonna get an email. Thanks, John. I really appreciate that.
With the Hi-Yo stuff, it always cracks me up because I will often tweet out SF Signal links, and John DiNardo wrote a I will often tweet his Kirkus reviews as well, and so he had a top five sci-fi popcorn books, and one of my followers had tweeted like, oh, I was really hoping Orville Redenbacher will be on the list. And then John promptly tweeted, "Hi-o!" I got a lot of hi-os in my my Twitter stream from DiNardo. So that
it's very interesting. DiNardo has a lot of hi-os in his Twitter stream, yet there was only one in the Lone Ranger movie.
Interesting. And I think only one person actually saw that movie, too.
Yeah, so, and it was me, and I'm still pissed.
Wow, yeah, really. I didn't think anybody was actually going to see that. So I guess it's you.
The one
review I heard about it was that there's a great opening action sequence and there's a great ending action sequence, and the rest of it is horrible. I don't even know if you'd go that far, I guess.
Jeff, did you see it? Hello, Jeff.
Nope.
Okay.
Don't watch movies.
Don't watch movies.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, I'm long overdue to go to the movies. The last movie I saw was the G.I. Joe movie. So, anyway. All right.
Which one? The first one or the second one?
The second one.
Really? Second one. You went to the second one?
I did.
You were lured in by ninjas, weren't you? You saw ninjas fighting on a mountainside and thought, it can't be that bad.
I thought it was about the same as the first, but I kind of was going into it believing that I thought that it would be better than the first, and it's not. That was just my opinion anyway, but
damn.
Different movie. But
that reminds me, I know that you're living in Jersey. I do have a bridge there that I've been trying to sell. I don't know if you'd be interested.
Does it get you into Manhattan?
Sure.
You know, yeah. Okay. Well, then there's bound to be money to be made on that. That's for sure. Well, anyway, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
Jeff, why don't you go first with your pick of the week?
All right, I'm going to go with the first issue of the revamped Red Sonja comic, which Gail Simone took over writing to much rejoicing on the internet, and that rejoicing is certainly well worth it. Though not an origin story, it certainly starts a story from the beginning and sort of gives Sonja a bit of added kick and motivation for the story that's to come.
How many issues are out?
I think it's just the one issue of the Simone book. A second one may have come out already, but I think it was just the one so far.
So there's one issue out and she hasn't been fired yet?
She's not working for DC anymore.
Yeah, that's not anything bad about Gail. That's something bad about DC. I'm just joking. I know that she was really excited about that, Jeff. She was like all over Twitter and Facebook and everything talking about, you know, how happy she was about that. Is she still doing the Bat book?
I have no idea. I haven't read any of the main DC titles in a while.
Okay. So what do you like about this one versus what they were doing before at Dynamite?
I think it's apples and oranges, but this one I found incredibly tight pacing, some very well laid out panel structure. Quite a few characters get introduced. They're done very well, and it has a bit more of a sword and sorcery vibe than the previous ones. One of the things I liked about it is that the Red Sonja comics we had before, the only interiors that you ever saw tended to be castles and temples. And here we actually see a city and, you know, a neighborhood and, caverns and stuff like that. The story goes on to a couple different canvases that we hadn't seen before in the previous iterations.
Interesting.
Cool. Very good. Patrick, what's your pick this week?
My pick this week is Pineapple Chutney.
And what is pineapple chutney? Besides something that sounds delicious.
I have no idea, but I heard it on the Food Network and I needed a pick, so.
Okay.
No clue.
What is it?
Okay. No clue. Seriously.
Oh, that's it. Okay. Yeah. So that's your pick. Okay.
That's my pick.
Okay. Okay. There you go. All right. My pick this week is Leviathan Wakes by James S.A. Corey. It is, which is a pseudonym for two writers. One is Daniel Abraham and the other is Ty Frank. I believe that's the other writer's name. And I am 30 pages from finishing it. I'm almost done with it. If we weren't recording the podcast today, I would be done by now probably, but I had to stop to do the podcast. It is fantastic, unless it totally ends horribly. in the last 30 pages. Just a great science fiction. It takes place in our solar system, which I haven't read a lot of the classic science fiction books, but a lot of the more modern science fiction books, you know, they take place in galaxies far, far away, and you know it's all kind of made up planets and that kind of thing. I think it's so cool the way the world that they put together, because it's our world, it's our solar system, and it's, you know, a lot of it takes place on various moons of Jupiter and moons of Saturn, and it's a very sort of believable what would happen 100, 200 years from now if we did get, were able to get our space travel together a little bit. And it's just great. It's like, it's part murder mystery. It's part, you know, just sort of sci-fi. It's great. I don't know. I mean, I'm not the first person to pick this book. This is a very popular book, and it's popular for a reason. So I'm just going to pile on and say, check it out. It is called Leviathan Wakes, and it is by James S.A. Corey. And I know there are already two other books out in the series. I believe it's Caliban's War and Abaddon's Gate are the other two, which I will be reading, I'm sure, shortly after that. So that is my pick, and Leviathan Wakes.
And yes. did you see their announcement? They actually put out the cover for the new James S.A. Corey Star Wars novel. They've actually written a Star Wars novel.
I remember hearing about that a while back, but I haven't. What's their Star Wars novel about? Like, what's the time
Han
period?
Han Solo. Something about, like, Han Solo. It's early.
Oh, well, I would read that, because this is, you know, I don't know. I'm always down with that. And I actually have the advanced reader arc for the Ben Kenobi book that our friend John Jackson Miller wrote. And I definitely want to get to that, because I read one of John Jackson Miller's Star Wars novels, and it was really good. And I would really like to see what he does with the Kenobi book, which I don't think is out yet. I think it actually comes out in August, like the end of August, probably about the time this podcast airs. But so
yeah, and I know they've put the cover out, but they don't actually have it on their Facebook page, which is bugging the crap out of me, because I was trying to find it to tell you exactly what the title of the book is. But yeah. I know they tweeted it, or they Facebooked it or something at one point, and that's where I saw it. So
yeah, no, well, I'll have to check that out too, because I'm a sucker for a Star Wars book, and when it's a really good author that I like their other work, then when they do a Star Wars book, I'm usually all over that. So very, very cool. All right. Well, let us get on to our main topic this week. And our main topic this week, again, because Jeff is a music guy like myself, we are going to talk about science fiction and fantasy movie, and we'll throw TV soundtracks in there too. I think much of the impact of a good science fiction show or a good science fiction movie is often related back to the soundtrack and how yeah. Yeah, I mean, and if you have a good composer and write some good themes, it can really make or break a movie, in my opinion. And obviously, the most classic example would be all the John Williams Star Wars score.
I would say the classic example would be Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan.
Mm.
Horner.
Who does the... James Horner does that one? Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. There's many. That's why I wanted to bring this up today. Let's talk about some of the soundtracks that we like, that we think are, you know, sort of classics, or to have a different take on what you could do with the music in a film. So, Jeff, what are some of your thoughts on this?
Well, I got two things to mention. Number one, you mentioned James Horner. James Horner got that gig because he had done the soundtrack to Battle Beyond the Stars, which was a B-movie space opera back when there were B-movies, which that soundtrack aped so much of the soundtrack of Star Trek the Motion Picture that I don't think anybody was surprised when he landed Wrath of Khan. My favorite Horner soundtrack, though, is the one he did for the movie Brainstorm with Natalie Wood and Christopher Walken. I thought that was really good. And I will also brown nose Mr. Hester a little here with Lisa Gerrard's soundtrack to The 13th Warrior, because all of those great scenes that he loves to quote would not have...
none of the excellent...
Wow.
Well, you know what? You're right, though. The 13th Warrior does have a great soundtrack.
Lisa Gerrard is from Dead Can Dance. Lisa Gerrard, she also worked on Gladiator. She also did the excellent soundtrack for the second Salem's Lot adaptation that was done on cable. Her soundtrack on that was great. She's one half of Dead Can Dance, who just toured again last year and put an album out. She's really big into world music, a lot of medieval stuff, hymns and spiritual music from various cultures, and that incorporates a lot. You really see that in her Gladiator, her work on the Gladiator soundtrack as well.
Very cool. Well, you know, we can, you know, obviously within really any big movie score, you know, you have your classic big orchestral scores, and, you know, quite often that's what is tied to these sorts of science fiction and fantasy movies. But maybe we can even talk about some scores that, you know, are a little different than that, that have a different vibe. So Jeff, what's sort of a non-traditional score that you like?
I would go with a few. I would go with possibly my favorite. I don't even want to call it a soundtrack just because there was so much music on the show, but the cartoon Samurai Jack had possibly one of the greatest varieties of music, because so much of the sequences in that show did not have dialogue on them. Much of the vibe was carried by the music alone, and it had rave, it had heavy metal, it had classical, it had jazz in some episodes. It was just a beautifully nice little montage of stuff. But there's other ones. There's a Bob Crow soundtrack to Barbarella, Alain Gouriger's Fantastic Planet soundtrack, which was all early electronic stuff. Mm-hmm. In a similar vein, Peter Thomas did the soundtrack for the German show Raum Patrol Orion, which had a nice, had an electric and also a jazzy vibe. And also he wrote the excellent music for the nightclub dance sequence from Raum Patrol Orion, which I recommend everybody go and YouTube immediately. And the one other one I would throw in there was when the show Lex was on, the soundtrack to that show was done by a guy named Marty Simon, which dealt with a lot of non-traditional instruments and a lot of actual song structure. Much of that soundtrack was actually done in the form of songs.
Well, it's nice to know that there was something positive that came out of that shitty show.
I love that.
I know you did.
Well, you know, now, Jeff, you've now given me two things to go watch, because Lex is one of those things that always comes up on Netflix, like that, hey, loser, you watched all of Farscape and all of the Stargate. Like, here's one of your other loser shows that you should watch. You know? So that always comes up, but I never actually watched it, but I will be sure to check it out even just for the music. And Samurai Jack, too. I read a really – that's up on Netflix now, too.
Oh, that's a great show.
As is all the Cartoon Network stuff, or a lot of it now. It came up a couple months ago. All of it came up because I think as Netflix was letting its Viacom contract run out, which then Amazon picked up. Well, because you know, Netflix had all the Nickelodeon shows. That was like the big thing. And if you have kids, I think most people who have kids and have Netflix, that's a big deal. And that was a big loss for them. And Amazon then went and picked it up. So we have the Amazon streaming too. So it was no big deal for us. There was literally like 2 days where my son couldn't watch SpongeBob. And, you know, thankfully, came back on Amazon. We were able to watch some SpongeBob. You know, they did pick up the Cartoon Network stuff. So there's lots of Cartoon Network stuff up on
Powerpuff Girls.
Mojo Jojo. Yeah. So there's all that. And someone, I think IO9 or some one of the big sites wrote a piece about Samurai Jack and how it's a show that everyone should watch. And so now that's another reason for me to watch it. In terms of some sort of non-traditional scores that I like, for Blade Runner, you have Vangelis's synthesizer score, which is it just sounds great and really fits the vibe of that movie so well. So I definitely would throw that one there. And although I've certainly talked about him before, and lots of people have talked about him in this particular score, I think you absolutely have to mention Bear McCreary and his Battlestar Galactica score, just because it really, now as the show went on, it did sort of get more traditional orchestral elements into it, but it always had those sort of tribal drums and it really, I mean,
but here's the thing about McCreary though, John, he's become almost, I want to use the verb Elfman-esque. And then now when you hear a soundtrack, you know that it's Bear McCreary because of those drums.
Yeah, well, you know, I think he has more variety to, because he works a lot.
But he also works those drums into the soundtrack a lot.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that because I've been listening. I just finished watching Defiance, and there's drums a little bit of that vibe to that. And I know he did the Da Vinci's Demon score. That's a little different. That's more of a sort of period piece where it is more sort of Baroque kind of sounding music in there. I know he did Eureka soundtrack too, and I don't know if that's very drum heavy. But he's also, you know, I just saw the other day that he's going to be doing the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. score, which I think is a big gig for him, you know. So I think that maybe helps him sort of make the transition to doing more sort of theatrical releases rather than just TV, I would imagine. So I was really glad to hear that for him. And because I know what you're saying, Patrick, the drums are definitely... and you know why? Because it's the same guy that plays on all that stuff. I saw a cool, and I think I mentioned it on the show before, I saw a cool little 10-minute documentary on the making of the Battlestar Galactica Blood and Chrome web series. And they had Bear McCreary kind of going through and talking about the making of that. And they had this one percussionist, and Bear was just sort of like, I can't do a score without him. You know, I forget what the guy's name is. And they just had him, and they had like the, you know, the big Japanese taiko drums and all the different ethnic drums around. And the guy's just like pounding the shit out of them. And it's like, yeah, that's the Bear McCreary sound, is that guy pounding away on those drums. But effective. And I think there was a real, you know, the starkness of just those drums and then a lot of silence, I think really set the vibe for a lot of that sort of desolate feeling in the early Battlestar Galactica episodes of them just being out in space and it being quiet. So I don't know. I mean, and he's working a lot, so I don't know. I really dig him.
I've said that the only redeeming quality for that shitty Battlestar Galactica movie, The Plan, that they made, was the music that he did in that. Specifically the main title song, it was like Apocalypse or something like that is the name of it. I forget. Mm-hmm. But that was like the only redeeming quality of that movie. Now, you talk about alternative stuff. I like the Horner stuff for the Star Trek. I still feel that Star Trek II is, it sticks with you. You know, those songs stick with you. You know them. You hear them. What I hate, and I'll throw this out there, is when a soundtrack is so easily identifiable with a specific movie or TV show, right? I mean, you know, it's like, oh, it immediately evokes that whatever it was you watched. What I hate is when they reuse that soundtrack in another movie.
Oh, yeah.
They'll lift a song or something and use it in another movie, just an orchestral piece. And it's like, whoa, wait a minute, that's from, you know, blah, 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 blah. I hate that. The Stargate...
movie soundtrack. Oh, I can't believe I didn't mention that. Yeah,
the movie soundtrack is really good, and then they borrowed from that to do the TV shows. So you know they've got a lot of that, you know that creepy that creepy kind of, you know, snake music is what I call it, because it's whenever the snakes are in your head. That's really good. Now I will throw out there that one of my favorite soundtracks is the soundtrack for the original Crow movie.
The orchestral score, or the song soundtrack.
The songs, because
that is a great soundtrack,
and they used it in the movie. It's not like the you know, here's the Danny Elfman Batman soundtrack. Here is the Prince inspired by soundtrack. Bullshit. That wasn't even in the movie. These songs were actually in the movie.
No, and you know what? Whoever put those songs together, did a great job, because it really does keep a vibe through the whole movie. And I'll tell you this too, I, being an 80s metal guy, I didn't, you know, I was so resistant to anything that wasn't 80s metal, and particularly to grunge, who was knocking away the popularity of my beloved 80s metal. You know, I loved that soundtrack, though. That's sort of the first thing that sort of made me a little more open-minded. It's like, hey, you know, the Stone Temple Pilots do have a couple of good songs, and, you know, The Cure's not so bad either. Like, this, you know, it really did, for me, it did lead me to checking out a lot of those bands, which I don't know if I would have otherwise.
Exactly, yeah, me too. And another one, I mean, they get a lot of shit for it. They get a lot of shit for it. But Queen... did a lot of movie soundtrack stuff in the 80s. And the songs themselves are pretty good. You know, the Flash Gordon soundtrack, pretty good. Mm-hmm. But when you get into Highlander and Princes of the Universe,
yeah,
that's good stuff. What were you trying to say, Jeff?
No, I was going to say Highlander as well, but the one other thing I wanted to throw out there when you talk about, you know, song-based soundtracks, another one that had a bit of a theme to it was the Wim Wenders movie Until the End of the World, which came out, I want to say, in 93. And the it takes place in 99. And the premise was the director had asked all these bands, U2 and quite a few bands, Graham Revell and stuff like that. He had asked them to write what they think is going to be their hit single for the summer of 99. And so bands like U2 and Talking Heads and stuff like that came up with these songs that really didn't sound like the stuff they were putting out at the time that the soundtrack came out. And as soundtracks come out that I can just listen to without necessarily having to remember the movie every single time I do it, that's one of the ones that's on top. Crow as well, though.
I'll throw out one more thing here. I always find it interesting that you have two types of soundtracks. You have like the orchestral, where it's actually original music, and Gladiator is a good example of that. That's an awesome soundtrack. The Alien soundtracks, you know, they have the same kind of stuff. So you have that sort of soundtrack that is almost a dying art. You know, they're not doing it as much. A lot of times now what they do is they just kind of try to go out and find some pop music to lay under the movie or you know, to tie in and do videos and this kind of crap. What I always find interesting is when a TV show or a movie or something like that appropriates a song and you've known that song forever, but now that song is associated with whatever it is, it immediately evokes whatever that is. And I'll explain that. The soundtrack for the television show Supernatural is all the classic rock kind of stuff that I like to listen to. And it's funny that the boys are it's like a recap of everything that's happened and look at all the shit they're in and you know, everything's hitting the fan now. They always like play Carry On My Wayward Son. And they've done that since the beginning. You know, it's like you turn on Supernatural and the boys are in trouble, their dad's gone, you know, all this shit's happening, and you turn on Supernatural and the first thing you hear is Carry On My Wayward Son. You know, and you're sitting there going, oh, this is going to be good. And now, whenever I hear that freaking song, I immediately think of the Winchester Boys. That is a talent or a skill or something where they've like invaded my brain. You know what I mean? They've usurped that song for that particular television property. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think it makes sense. And just to, you know, cut a comment on what you were saying earlier, I don't necessarily agree that orchestral scores are a dying art. I would say still predominantly in most movies that you see released, they still do have an unless it's a real low budget movie. If it's anything with a big budget, there's going to be an orchestral score of some kind there. Even TV to a certain extent, there is still orchestral scores. A lot of times, if it's a lower budget thing, it's a little bit of orchestra with, you know, some more synthesizer-based things. And samples sound so good these days that depending on the kind of music you write for it, you don't even notice. Farscape, for instance, I watched a little documentary that was included on one of the DVDs with the composer of that, and I was really surprised to find out that they almost never had a real orchestra on that show. It was all samples. String samples. I mean, the guy composed real music and everything, but he was very limited in his budget. They occasionally, for like the last episode of the season, they would give him the budget to hire an orchestra, but 99% of the Farscape stuff is samples and synths and stuff. So it's it could be done, and they still do it. But I think for a big movie, you're still going to have a big orchestra, and that, you know, and that's the only place where orchestras work anymore is movies, and even more so in big budget video games. Yeah,
that's the other thing I wanted to throw out there. Video games, Silent Hill video game, awesome, creepy soundtrack. World of Warcraft, awesome soundtrack. You know, I know a lot of writers who look for mood music to play when they're writing, And a lot of them go to stuff like that. You know, the Skyrim soundtrack, Silent Hill. I remember Silent Hill actually, when you bought the game, you got a second disc that was the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
So they gave you the soundtrack as part of the game. World of Warcraft has a fantastic soundtrack. I mean, some great,
I actually met stuff. Met the composer for the World of Warcraft music. He was at Nerdtacular, because you know, Nerdtacular, they do the Instance podcast, and they are pretty tied into the World of Warcraft. And subsequently, over the last few years, they have a pretty tight relationship with Blizzard's, the company that makes World of Warcraft.
Yes,
am I correct there? Yes. So, and Blizzard in Denver?
No, Blizzard is in Anaheim.
Oh, okay. Anyway, I thought they were kind of close, but or maybe they were just there for Mile High Con or something like that. Or anyway, the guy that does the music for World of Warcraft was actually at Nerdtacular, and got a chance to hear him on a panel and talk to him a little bit. But it's a pretty big. I mean, you have a big budget game like that. You know, music is really important, and they still put a lot of money and a lot of effort into making the music good. So
now I will say this: there's a couple songs on there that when they play, I do suddenly want to go up to the bar and order some mead. Anyway, Jeff, what were you going to say?
One thing I did want to mention when we talk about soundtracks, back in the early 90s, there was a trend for bands, string ensembles, music, soundscape artists, etc., to do live performances where they would perform a live soundtrack accompaniment to a classic silent movie. And a lot of these have come out on disc and sometimes on DVD. I know there was that big re-release of Metropolis that had some Queen songs on it and stuff like that, that actually made a cinematic release. But there was also a excellent Metropolis soundtrack that was done by the band Clubfoot Orchestra, and they toured extensively on that in the U.S. in the mid-90s. And two other ones I want to throw out real quick, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the original German film, with the Art Zoid soundtrack, which was a German avant-garde synth combo. Really, really good, really moody stuff, really actually changes the meaning of a lot of the visuals when you watch it. And Gary Lucas, who used to play with Captain Beefheart, he did a one-man accompaniment to the movie The Golem, which I actually got to see him perform live in Hartford in 95 or 96, I think. Really good. He had about six different guitars on stage, and he would have all kinds of effects, and he would do these really funky themes, and it was interesting because none of it was really improv. It was a full-blown score with character themes and stuff like that, and that was really big, and a lot of those are available on either standalone CD or a DVD with the movie included.
Very, very cool. All right. Well, it is about time to wrap it up for me this week. Just check out my website, johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Jeff, what would you like to leave our listeners with today?
I blog at Gravity Lens at Bad Day Studio. I'm on a couple podcasts on SF Signal in the next couple weeks. I Twitter at JeffPatterson11. I have an ebook, Don't Tweet Where You Eat, available on Kindle, and I will be at Worldcon, and I will be selling prints. There's a link to the prints I'm going to have for sale of science fiction and fantasy black and white illustrations. There's a link to them on my website.
Me, Jeff, and Donardo at WorldCon. This is either going to be the coolest fucking thing ever, or there will be restraining orders.
All right, Patrick, what do you have? What would you like to wrap it up with today?
I would like to wrap it up with this, John. I could stay awake just to hear you breathing. Watch you smile when you were sleeping while you're far away and dreaming. I could spend my life in this surrender. I could stay lost in this moment forever.
You know,
every
Patrick
moment
usually
spent with you is a moment I treasure. Don't want to close my eyes. I don't want to fall asleep because I'd miss you, baby, and I don't want to miss a thing.
Well, you know, Patrick usually saves those kind of words until we're off mic, you know. Like, you know, when we're not recording, he usually says those things to me, but thank you, Patrick.
I would put out there that is the most hated and most loved soundtrack song of all time.
It sure is.
Aerosmith, yep.
Yeah.
I'd like to say that when Patrick dies, which hopefully is many, many years from now, Satan has a special job set up for him in hell, where he will be selecting personalized soundtracks for the souls of the damned.
That seems like a good job for Patrick. I think he would do well at that. So Patrick's website is atfmb.com. You can follow him on Twitter at atfmb. And what else would you want to tell people about, Patrick?
That's it.
All righty. All right, everybody. Well, we will see you next week. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
tat savitur varem Margo deva seianti mai Dio
gold finger. He's the man with the Midas touch. A spider's touch. Such a cold finger beckons you to enter his web of sin.
Thank you. in constant sorrow all through his days. I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my where I was born and raised, the place where he was born and raised. For 6 long years I've been in trouble, no pleasure here on earth I found.
Thanks, Mo.
I'd like to say thank you on behalf of the group and ourselves, and I hope we pass the audition.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.